Marsupial and Miss Grebe, Bentham said. And their grim, Alexei. The grim bear, on second look, appeared to be protecting the wax imbrins. The ladies were posed calmly around it, while the bear was raised on its hind legs, frozen in mid-roar while swiping its paw at an enemy. Its other paw rested almost sweetly on one of the imbrin's shoulders, and her fingers were hooked around one of its long nails, as if to demonstrate her casual mastery over such a fearsome creature. Alexei was P.T.'s great-uncle, Bentham said. Say hello to your uncle, P.T. P.T. grunted.
If only you could do that with Hollows, Emma whispered to me.
How long does it take to train a grimbear? I asked Bentham.
Years, he replied. Grims are naturally very independent.
Years, I whispered to Emma.
Emma rolled her eyes.
And is Alexei made of wax, too? She said to Bentham.
Oh, no, he's taxidermy.
Apparently Bentham's aversion to stuffing peculiar folk did not extend to peculiar animals. If Addison were here, I thought, there'd be fireworks. I shivered. Emma ran a warm hand up my back. Bentham noticed, too, and said,
Forgive me. I so seldom have visitors that I can't help showing off my collection when they come. Now, I keep promising tea, and tea there shall be.
Bentham pointed his cane, and P.T. resumed walking. We followed them out of the dust-sheeted artifact storerooms through other parts of the house. It was in many ways the home of an average rich man. There was a marble-columned entry hall, a formal dining room with tapestried walls and seating for dozens, wings whose sole purpose seemed to be the display of tastefully arranged furnishings. But in each room, alongside everything else, were always a few objects from Bentham's peculiar collection.
15th-century Spain, he said, indicating a gleaming suit of armor standing in a hall. Had it made new. Fits me like a glove.
At last we came to the library, the most beautiful I'd ever seen. Bentham told P.T. to set him down, brushed fur from his jacket, and showed us in. The room was 3 stories high at least, with shelves rising to dizzying heights above us. An array of staircases, catwalks, and rolling ladders had been constructed to reach them.
I confess I haven't read them all, Bentham said, but I'm working on it.
He ushered us toward a battalion of couches surrounding a flaming hearth whose warmth filled the room. Waiting by the fire were Sharon and Nim.
Call me an untrustworthy lout, Sharon hissed,
but before he berated me further, Bentham shooed him away to fetch us blankets. We were under the protection of the master's good graces, and Sharon's tongue-lashing would have to wait. Within a minute we were seated on a couch and wrapped in blankets. Nim fluttered around preparing tea on gilded trays, and P.T., curled before the flames, was fast settling into a state of hibernation. I tried to resist the feeling of cozy contentedness that was beginning to settle over me and focus on our unfinished business. The big questions and seemingly intractable problems. Our friends and imbrins. The absurd and hopeless task we had assigned ourselves. It was enough to crush me if I thought about it all at once. So I asked Nim for 3 lumps of sugar and enough cream to turn the tea white, then downed it in 3 gulps and asked for more. Sharon had retreated to a corner where he could sulk but still overhear our conversation. Emma was eager to dispense with the formalities.
So, she said, can we talk now?
Bentham ignored her. He was sitting across from us, but staring at me, the oddest little grin on his face.
What?
I said, wiping a dribble of tea from my chin.
It's uncanny, he replied. You're the spitting image.
Of who?
Of your grandfather, of course.
I lowered my teacup.
You knew him?
I did. He was a friend to me, long ago, when I badly needed one. I glanced at Emma. She'd gone a bit pale and was clenching her teacup.
He died a few months ago, I said.
Yes. I was very sorry to hear it, Bentham said. And surprised, to be honest, that he held out as long as he did. I assumed he'd been killed years ago. He had so many enemies, but he was exceedingly talented, your grandfather.
What was the nature of your friendship, exactly? Said Emma, her tone like a police interrogator's.
And you must be Emma Bloom, Bentham said, finally looking at her. I've heard a great deal about you.
She seemed surprised.
You have?
Oh, yes. Abraham was very fond of you.
That's news to me, she said, blushing.
You're even prettier than he said you were.
She clenched her jaw.
Thank you, she said flatly. How did you know him?
Bentham's smile wilted.
Down to business, then.
If you wouldn't mind.
Not at all, he said, though his demeanor had cooled by a few degrees. Now, you asked me before about the Siberia room, and I know, Miss Bloom, that you were unsatisfied with the answer I gave.
Yes, but we are more interested in Jacob's grandfather and why you brought us here.
They are related, I promise. That room, and this house generally, is the place to begin.
Okay, I said. Tell us about the house.
Bentham took a breath and steepled his fingers against his lips for a moment, thinking. Then he said,
This house is filled with priceless artifacts I've brought back over a lifetime of expeditions, but none are more valuable than the house itself. It is a machine, a device of my own invention. I call it the Panlupticon.
Mr. Bentham's a genius, Nim said, laying a plate of sandwiches before us. Sandwich, Mr. Bentham?
Bentham waved him away. But even that is not quite bedrock, he continued. My story begins long before this house was built, when I was a lad about your age, Jacob. My brother and I fancied ourselves explorers. We pored over the maps of Perplexus Anomalous, and dreamed of visiting all the loops he'd discovered, of finding new ones and visiting them not just once, but again and again. In this way we hoped to make Peculiardom great again. He leaned forward. Do you understand what I mean? I frowned. Make it great with maps? No, not just with maps. Ask yourself. What makes us weak, as a people?
Whites? Emma guessed.
Hollows? I said.
Before either of them existed, Bentham prodded.
Emma said, Persecution by normals?
No, that is just a symptom of our weakness.
What makes us weak is geography. There are, by my rough estimate, some 10,000 peculiars in the world today. We know there must be, just as we know there must be other planets in the universe that harbor intelligent life. It is mathematically mandatory. He smiled and sipped his tea. Now, just imagine 10,000 peculiars, all with astounding talents, all in one place and united by a common cause. They'd be a power to be reckoned with, no?
I suppose so, Emma said.
Most definitely so, Bentham said. but we are splintered by geography into hundreds of weak subunits. 10 peculiars here, 12 there, because it is extraordinarily difficult to travel from a loop in the Australian outback, for example, to a loop in the Horn of Africa. There are not only the inherent dangers of normals and the natural world to consider, but the dangers of aging forward during a long journey. The tyranny of geography precludes all but the most cursory visits between distant loops, even in this modern era of air travel. He paused for a moment before continuing, his eyes scanning the room. Now then, imagine there was a link between that loop in Australia and the one in Africa. Suddenly, those two populations could develop a relationship, trade with each other, learn from each other, band together to defend each other in times of crisis. All sorts of exciting possibilities arise, which were previously impossible. And gradually, as more and more such connections are made, the peculiar world is transformed from a collection of far-flung tribes hiding in isolated loops to a mighty nation, united and strong. Bentham had grown increasingly animated as he spoke, and at this last bit he'd raised his hands and spread his fingers like he was grasping for an invisible pull-up bar. "Hence the machine?" I ventured. "Hence the machine," he said, lowering his hands. "We'd been searching, my brother and I, for an easier way to explore the peculiar world, and instead we hit upon a way to unite it. The Panlupticon was to be the savior of our people, an invention that would change the nature of peculiar society forever. It works like this. You begin here, in the house, with a small piece of the machine called a shuttle. It fits in your hand," he said, opening his palm. "You take it with you, out of the house, out of the loop, and then across the present to another loop, which could be on the other side of the world, or the next village over. And when you return here, the shuttle will have collected and brought back the DNA-like signature of that other loop, which can be used to grow a second entrance to it, here, inside this house." "In that hallway upstairs," Emma guessed, "with all the doors and little plaques." "Exactly," said Bentham. "Every one of those rooms is a loop entrance that my brother and I, over the course of many years, harvested and brought back. With the Panlupticon, the initial arduous trek of first contact has to be made only once, and every return trip thereafter is instantaneous." "Like laying telegraph lines," Emma said. "Just so," said Bentham. "And in that way, theoretically, the house becomes a central repository for all loops everywhere." I thought about that. About how hard it had been to reach Miss Peregrine's loop the first time. What if instead of having to go all the way to a little island off the coast of Wales, I could have entered Miss Peregrine's loop from my closet in Englewood? I could have lived both lives, at home with my parents, and here with my friends and Emma. Except, if that had existed, Grandpa Portman and Emma never would have had to break up, which was a sentence so strange it gave me the tailbone-tingling willies. Bentham stopped and sipped his tea.
"Cold," he said, and set it down.
Emma peeled off her blanket, got up, crossed the floor to Bentham's couch, and dipped the tip of her index finger in his tea. In a moment, it was boiling again. He grinned at her.
"Fantastic," he said. She removed her finger. "One question."
"I'll bet I know what it is," Bentham said.
"Okay. What is it?"
"If such a wonderful thing really exists, why haven't you heard about it before now?"
"That's it," she said, and returned to sit next to me.
You never heard about it, no one did, because of the unfortunate trouble with my brother. Bentham's expression darkened. The machine was born with his help, but ultimately, he was its downfall as well. Ultimately, the Panlupticon was never used as a tool to unite our people as it was intended, but for quite the opposite purpose. The trouble began when we realized that the task of visiting every loop in the world so that we might recreate their entrances here was laughable at best, so far beyond our abilities that it bordered on delusional. We needed help, and a great deal of it. Luckily, my brother was such a charismatic and convincing fellow that recruiting all the help we needed proved easy. Before long, we had a small army of young, idealistic peculiars willing to risk life and limb to help us achieve our dream. What I didn't realize at the time was that my brother had a different dream than I did. A hidden agenda. With some effort, Bentham stood up. "There is a legend," he said. "You might know it, Miss Bloom." Tapping with his cane, he moved across the floor to the shelves and pulled down a small book. "It's the tale of a lost loop, a kind of afterworld where our peculiar souls are stored after we die."
"Abaton," Emma said.
"Sure, I've heard of it, but it's just a legend." "Perhaps you can tell the tale," he said, "for the benefit of our neophyte friend." Bentham hobbled back to the couches and handed me the book. It was slim and green and so old it crumbled around the edges. On the front was printed, "Tales of the Peculiar."
"I've read this," I said. "Part of it, at least."
"This edition is nearly 600 years old," said Bentham. "It was the last to contain the story Miss Bloom is about to recount, because it was regarded as dangerous. For a time, it was a criminal act simply to tell it, and thus the book you hold is the only volume in the history of peculiardom ever to have been banned." I opened the book. Every page was handwritten in ornate, superhumanly neat script, and every margin was crowded with illustrations.
"It's been a long time since I heard it," Emma said tentatively.
"I'll help you along," Bentham said, lowering himself gently onto the couch. "Go on."
"Well," Emma began, "the legend goes that back in the old days, the really, really thousands of years ago old days, there was a special loop peculiars went to and they died."
"Peculiar heaven," I said.
"Not quite. We didn't stay there for all eternity or anything. It was more like a library."
She seemed uncertain of her word choice and looked to Bentham.
"Right?"
"Yes," he said, nodding. "It was thought that peculiar souls were a precious thing in limited supply, and it would be a waste to take them with us to the grave. Instead, at the end of our lives, we were to make a pilgrimage to the library, where our souls would be deposited for future use by others. Even in spiritual matters, we peculiars have always been frugal-minded." "The first law of thermodynamics," I said. He looked at me blankly. "Matter can neither be created nor destroyed, or souls, in this case." Sometimes I surprise myself with the things I remember from school. "The principle is similar, I suppose," said Bentham. "The ancients believed that only a certain number of peculiar souls were available to humanity, and that when a peculiar was born, he or she checked one out, as you or I might borrow a book from a library." He gestured at the stacks around us. "But when your life, your borrowing term, was over, the soul had to be returned." Bentham gestured to Emma. "Please, go on."
"So,"
Emma said. There is this library. I always imagined it filled with beautiful glowing books, each containing a peculiar soul. For thousands of years, people checked out souls and returned them just before they died, and everything was rosy. Then, one day, someone figured out that you could break into the library even if you weren't about to die. And he did break in, and then robbed the place. He stole the most powerful souls he could find and used them to wreak havoc. Emma looked at Bentham. Right?
Factually correct, if a bit artless in the telling, Bentham said.
Used them? I said. How?
By combining their powers with his own, Bentham explained. Eventually the library's guardians killed the rogue, took back the stolen souls, and set things aright. But the genie was out of the bottle, so to speak. The knowledge that the library could be breached became a poison that spread throughout our society. Whoever controlled the library could dominate all peculiardom, and before long more souls were stolen. There dawned a dark time, in which the power-mad waged epic battles against one another for control of Abaddon and the Library of Souls. Many lives were lost. The land was scorched. Famine and pestilence reigned, while peculiars with power beyond imagination murdered one another with floods and lightning bolts. This is where normals got their tales of gods fighting for supremacy in the sky. Their clash of the Titans was our battle for the Library of Souls.
I thought you said this story wasn't real, I said.
I'm getting to that, Bentham said, then turned to Nim, who was hovering nearby. You can go, Nim. We don't need any more tea.
Sorry, sir. Didn't mean to eavesdrop, sir, but this is my favorite part.
Then sit!
Nim dropped cross-legged to the floor and propped his chin on his hands. As I was saying, for a short but terrible time, destruction and misery befell our people. Control of the library changed hands often, accompanied by immense bloodletting. Then, one day, it stopped. The self-declared King of Abaddon had been killed in battle, and the one who killed him was on his way to claim the library for himself. But he never found it. Overnight, the loop had disappeared.
Disappeared? I said.
There one day, gone the next, said Emma.
Poof!
Said Nim. According to legend, the Library of Souls was located in the hills of the ancient city of Abaddon. But when the would-be king arrived to claim his prize, the library was gone. So is the town. Gone, as if they'd never been there at all. A smooth green meadow in their place.
That's crazy, I said.
There's nothing to it, though, Emma said. It's just an old tale.
The legend of the lost loop, I said, reading the page that the book in my hands was open to. We may never know for certain if Abaddon is a real place, Bentham said, his lips spreading into a sphinx's smile. That's what makes it a legend. But like rumors of buried treasure, the legendariness of the story has not stopped people, over the centuries, from searching for it. It is said that Perplexus Anomalous himself committed years to the hunt for the lost loop of Abaddon, which is how he began to discover so many of the loops that appear on his famous maps.
I didn't know that, said Emma. I suppose something good came of it then.
And something very bad, Bentham added. My brother, too, believed the story. Foolishly, I forgave him this frailty, and I ignored it, realizing too late how completely it drove him. By then, my charismatic brother had convinced our small army of young recruits that it was true. Abaddon was real. The Library of Souls was discoverable.
Perplexus had gotten so close, he told them, and all that was left to do was to complete his work. Then the vast and dangerous power contained in the library could belong to us, to them. I waited too long, and this idea became a cancer. They searched and searched for the lost loop, mounting expedition after expedition, each failure only fueling their zeal. The goal of uniting peculiardom was forgotten. All along, my brother had cared only about ruling it, like the would-be peculiar gods of old. And when I tried to challenge him and regain control of the machine I'd built, he smeared me as a traitor, turned the others against me, and locked me in a cell. Bentham had been squeezing the crook of his cane like a neck he wished he could wring, but now he looked up, his face gaunt as a death mask. "Perhaps by now you've guessed his name." My eyes snapped to Emma. Hers were wide as moons. We said it together. "Call." Bentham nodded. "His real name is Jack." Emma leaned forward.
"Then your sister is..."
"My sister is Alma Peregrine," he said. We gaped at Bentham, thunderstruck. Could the man before us really be Miss Peregrine's brother? I'd known she had two. She'd mentioned them once or twice, even shown me a picture of them as boys. She told me the story, too, of how their quest for immortality led to the disaster in 1908 that turned them and their followers into Hologast, and, later, the Whites we knew and feared. But she'd never mentioned either brother by name, and her story bore little resemblance to the one Bentham had just laid out. "If what you say is true," I said, "then you must be a White." Nim's mouth fell open.
"Mr. Bentham is not!"
He was ready to stand and defend his master's honor when Bentham waved him off. "It's all right, Nim. They've only heard Alma's version of things. But there are gaps in her knowledge."
"I don't hear you denying it," said Emma.
"I'm not a White," Bentham said sharply. He was also not accustomed to being questioned by the likes of us, and his pride was beginning to poke through his genteel veneer. "Then would you mind if we checked?" I said. "Just so we can be sure?"
"Not at all," Bentham said.
He pushed himself up with his cane and hobbled into the no-man's land between our couches. P.T. raised his head, idly curious, while Nim turned his back, angry that his master should have to endure such humiliations. We met Bentham on the carpet. He bent down a little so we wouldn't have to stand on our tiptoes. He was surprisingly tall, and waited while we searched the whites of his eyes for signs of contact lenses or other fakery. His pupils were terribly bloodshot, as if he hadn't slept in days, but otherwise unsuspicious. We stepped back.
"Okay, you're not a White," I said, "but that means you can't be Call's brother."
"I'm afraid the set of assumptions you are working from is erroneous," he said. "I was responsible for my brother and his followers becoming Hologast, but I never became one myself."
"You made the Hollows?" Emma said. "Why?"
Bentham turned and gazed into the fire.
"It was a terrible mistake. An accident."
We waited for him to explain. It seemed to cost him real effort to drag up the story from wherever he'd hidden it away.
"It was my fault for letting things go on as long as they did," he said heavily. "I kept telling myself that my brother wasn't as dangerous as he seemed."
It was only after he imprisoned me, and it was too late to act, that I realized how wrong I'd been. He stepped closer to the warmth of the fire and knelt down to stroke the bear's wide belly, letting his fingers get lost in P.T.'s fur. I knew Jack had to be stopped, and not simply for my own sake, nor because there was any danger he'd ever find the Library of Souls. No, it was clear his ambitions had grown beyond that. For months he'd been molding our recruits into the foot soldiers of a dangerous political movement. He cast himself as an underdog fighting to wrest control of our society from what he called the infantilizing influence of Imbrins.
"Imbrins are the reason our society still exists," Emma said bitterly.
"Yes," Bentham said, "but you see, my brother was terribly jealous. From the time we were boys, Jack envied our sister's power and status. Our inborn abilities were puny compared to hers. By her third birthday, the elder Imbrins who cared for us knew Alma was a great talent. People made such a fuss over her, and it drove Jack mad. When she was a baby, he would pinch her, just to see her cry. When she practiced turning into a bird, he would chase her and pluck her feathers." I saw an angry flame curl up from one of Emma's fingers, which she extinguished in her tea. "That ugliness only deepened over time," Bentham said. "Jack was able to harness and exploit the same poisonous envy latent in some of our fellow peculiars. He held meetings and made speeches, rallying malcontents to his cause. Devil's Acre was fertile ground, since many of the peculiars here were exiles, alienated from and hostile to the Imbrinic matriarchy."
"The Clay Wings," Emma said. "Before the whites became whites, that's what they called themselves. Miss Peregrine taught us a little about them."
"We don't need their wings," Jack used to preach. "We'll grow wings of our own." He meant this metaphorically, of course. But they used to march around wearing fake wings as a symbol of their movement. Bentham stood up and motioned us toward the bookshelves. "Look here. I still have a photo or two from those days. A few he wasn't able to destroy." He pulled down an album from a shelf and turned to a picture of a large crowd listening to a man speak. "Ah, here's Jack giving one of his hateful speeches." The crowd, almost exclusively male, wore big, sturdy hats and were packed 30 deep, balancing on boxes and clinging to fence tops to hear what Call had to say. Bentham turned the page and showed us another photo. This one of two hale young men in suits and hats, one grinning earnestly, the other expressionless.
"That's me on the left, Jack on the right," Bentham said. "Jack smiled only when he was trying to get something out of you."
Lastly, he turned to a photo of a boy with a pair of large, owlish wings that spread from behind his shoulders. He was slouched on a pedestal and regarded the camera with quiet contempt, one eye hidden behind his cocked hat. Printed across the bottom were the words, "We don't need their wings." "One of Jack's recruiting posters," Bentham explained. Bentham held the second photo closer, studying his brother's face.
"There had always been a darkness in him," he said. "But I refused to see it. Alma's vision was sharper. She pushed Jack away early. But Jack and I were close in age and in mentality, or so I thought. We were chums, thick as thieves. But he hid his true self from me. I didn't see him for what he was until the day I said, 'Jack, you have to stop this,' and he had me beaten and thrown into a lightless hole to die. By then it was too late."
Bentham looked up, his eyes reflecting the fire's glow.
It's quite something to realize you mean less than nothing to your own brother.
He was quiet for a moment, tangled in an awful memory.
But you didn't die, said Emma. You turned them into hollows.
Yes.
How?
I tricked them. Into becoming horrible monsters? I said.
I never meant to turn them into monsters. I meant only to get rid of them.
He returned stiffly to the couch and lowered himself onto the cushions.
I was starving, near death, when it came to me. The perfect story with which to ensnare my brother. A lie as old as humanity itself. The fountain of youth.
With my finger I scratched it into the dirt of my cell floor, the steps of an obscure loop manipulation technique that could reverse and forever eliminate the dangers of aging forward. Or so it seemed. In reality, that was just a side effect of what the steps truly described, which was an arcane and largely forgotten procedure to collapse loops quickly and permanently in an emergency. I pictured the auto-destruct button of a sci-fi cliché, a supernova in miniature, stars winking out.
I never expected my trick to work so well, Bentham said. A member of the movement whose sympathy I had earned circulated my technique as his own, and Jack believed it. He led his followers to a distant loop to enact the procedure, and there, I hoped, they would slam the door behind themselves forever.
But that's not what happened, said Emma.
Is that when half of Siberia got blown up? I asked.
The reaction was so strong, it lasted a day and a night, said Bentham. There are photos of it, and of the aftermath.
He nodded at the album on the floor, then waited while we found the pictures. One, taken at night in some indistinct wilderness, was striped by a jet of vertical flame, a massive but distant release of white-hot energy that lit the night like a skyscraper-sized Roman candle. The other was a ruined village made up of rubble and cracked houses and trees raked clean of bark. Just looking at it, I could almost hear a lonely wind blowing, the palpable silence of a place robbed suddenly of life.
Bentham shook his head. Never in my wildest dreams did I imagine what would crawl out of that collapsed loop, he said. For a brief time afterward, things were quiet. Released from confinement, I began to recover. I regained control of my machine. It seemed my brother's dark age had drawn to a close, but it was only the beginning.
That was the start of the Hollow Wars, Emma said.
Soon we began to hear stories about creatures made of shadow. They were emerging from the ruined forests to feed on peculiars, and normals, and animals, and anything that would fit between their jaws.
"Once I saw one eat a car," Nim said.
I said, "A car?"
"I was inside it," he replied.
We waited for him to elaborate.
"And?" said Emma.
"I got away," he said, shrugging. "The steering column got stuck in his throat."
"May I continue?" said Bentham.
"Of course, sir. My apologies."
As I was saying, there wasn't much that would stop these new abominations, save the odd steering column and loop entrances. Luckily, we had plenty of those, so most of us dealt with the hologast problem by staying put in our loops, venturing out only when we had no choice. The hollows didn't end our lives, but they made them vastly more difficult, isolated, and dangerous.
"What about the whites?" I asked.
I imagine he's coming to that, said Emma.
I am, said Bentham. 5 years after encountering my first Hollowghast, I met my first white. There was a knock at my door after midnight. I was in my house, safe inside my loop, or so I thought. But when I opened the door, there stood my brother Jack, a bit worse for wear, but looking like his old self, save his dead eyes, which were blank as unmarked paper. Emma and I had folded ourselves into cross-legged positions, and were now leaning toward Bentham, hanging on his every word. Bentham stared over our heads with haunted eyes. He'd consumed enough peculiars to fill his hollow soul and turn himself into something that resembled my brother, but wasn't quite. What little humanity he'd clung to through the years was gone completely, leaked away with the color in his eyes. A white is to the peculiar he once was, as a thing copied many times is to its original. Detail is lost, and color. "What about memory?" I asked. Jack retained his. A pity. Otherwise he might have forgotten all about Abaton and the Library of Souls, and what I'd done to him.
"How did he find out it was you?" Emma asked.
"Chalk it up to brotherly intuition. And then, one day, when he had nothing better to do, he tortured me until I confessed to it." Bentham nodded at his legs. "Never quite healed properly, as you can see."
"But he didn't kill you," I said.
"Whites are pragmatic creatures, and revenge is not a great motivator," Bentham said. "Jack was more obsessed than ever with finding Abaton, but to do it, he needed my machine, and me, to operate it. I became his prisoner and his slave, and Devil's Acre, the secret headquarters for a small but influential contingent of whites bent on finding and cracking open the Library of Souls, which is, you'll have guessed by now, their ultimate goal."
"I thought they wanted to recreate the reaction that turned them into hollows," I said. "Only bigger and better. Do it right this time," I said, making air quotes. Bentham frowned.
"Where did you hear that?"
"A white told us just before he died," Emma said. "He said that's why they needed all the Imbrins, to make the reaction more powerful."
"Utter nonsense," Bentham said. "Probably just a cover story to throw you off the scent. Though it's possible the white who told you this lie believed it. Only Jack's innermost circle knew about the search for Abaton."
"But if they didn't need the Imbrins for their reaction," I said, "then why'd they go to all the trouble of kidnapping them?"
"Because the lost loop of Abaton isn't just lost," said Bentham. "According to legend, before it was lost, it was also locked, and it was Imbrins who locked it. 12 of them, to be exact, who came together from 12 far-flung corners of peculiardom, to open Abaton again, if you can manage to find it, would require those same 12 Imbrins, or their successors. So it's no surprise that my brother has kidnapped precisely 12 Imbrins, whom he spent many years hunting and tracking."
"I knew it," I said. "It had to be something more than just recreating the reaction that turned them into hollows." "Then he's found it," Emma said. "Call wouldn't have pulled the trigger and kidnapped the Imbrins if he didn't know where Abaton was."
"I thought you said it was legendary," I said. "Now you're talking like it's a real. Which is it?" "The official position of the Council of Imbrins is that the Library of Souls is nothing but a story," Bentham said.
"I don't care what the Council says," said Emma. "What do you say?"
"My opinions are my own," he said evasively. "But if the library is real, and Jack manages to find and open it, he still won't be able to steal its souls. He doesn't know it, but there's a third element he needs, a third key."
"And what's that?" I said.
"No one can take the soul jars. To most everyone they would be invisible and intangible. Even Imbrans can't touch them. In the stories, only special adepts called librarians can see and handle them, and a librarian hasn't been born for 1,000 years. If the library exists, all Jack would find there are empty shelves."
"Well, that's a relief," I said.
"Yes and no," said Emma. "What's he going to do when he figures out the Imbrans he spent so long hunting are useless to him? He'll go mad."
"That's what I worry about most," Bentham said. "Jack has a bad temper, and when the dream he's nurtured for so long dies..."
I tried to imagine what that could mean, all the tortures a man like Call might be capable of, but my mind recoiled from the idea. It seemed the same horrors had broadcast themselves to Emma, because what she said next was sharp and charged with anger.
"We're going to get them back."
"We share a common goal," Bentham said. "To destroy my brother and his kind, and to save my sister and hers. Together, I believe we can do both."
He looked so small in that moment, sunk into the massive couch, cane leaning against his rickety legs, that I nearly laughed.
"How?"
I said. "We'd need an army."
"Incorrect," he replied. "The whites could easily repel an army. Luckily, we have something even better."
He looked at Emma and me, his lips curling into a smile.
"We have the both of you. And luckily for you, you have me."
Bentham leaned on his cane and rose slowly to his feet.
"We have to get you inside their fortress."
"It seems pretty impenetrable," I said.
"That's because it is, conventionally speaking," Bentham replied. "In the years when Devil's Acre was a prison loop, it was designed to hold the worst of the worst. After the whites returned here, they adopted it as their home, and what had been an inescapable prison became their impenetrable fortress."
"But you have a way in," Emma guessed.
"I might, if you can help me," Bentham said. "When Jack and his whites came, they stole the heart of my Panlupticon. They forced me to break my own machine, to copy its loops and recreate them inside their fortress, so that they could continue their work in a more protected location."
"So there's another one?" I said. Bentham nodded.
"Mine is the original and theirs is the copy," he said. "The two are linked, and there are doorways in each that lead to the other."
Emma sat up straight.
"You mean... we can use your machine to get inside theirs?"
"Correct."
"Then why haven't you?" I said. "Why didn't you do it years ago?"
"Jack broke my machine so irrevocably that I thought it could never be fixed," Bentham said. "For years, only one room has remained functional, the one that leads to Siberia. But though we've searched and searched, we haven't found a way through it into Jack's machine."
I remembered the man we'd seen peering into the crevasse, looking for a door, it seemed, deep in the snow.
"We need to open other doors, other rooms," Bentham said. "But to do that, I need an adequate replacement for the part Jack stole, the dynamo at the heart of my Panlupticon. I've long suspected there's something that might work,
a very powerful, very dangerous item, but though it exists right here in Devil's Acre, getting one has never been possible for me. Until now. He turned to me. My boy, I need you to bring me a hologast. I agreed to, of course. I would have said yes to almost anything then if I thought it might help free our friends. It occurred to me only after I'd said it, though, and Bentham had clapped his hands around mine and shook them, that I had no idea where to get a hologast. I was sure there were plenty inside the White's Fortress, but we'd already established that there was no getting inside. That's when Sharon stepped out of the shadows that had been growing at the edges of the room to give us a bit of good news.
"Remember your friend who got smashed by a falling bridge?" he said. "Turns out he's not quite dead. They pulled him out of the ditch a few hours ago."
"They?" I said.
"The pirates. They've got him chained and caged down the end of Oozing Street. He's causing quite a stir, I hear."
"That's it, then," Emma said, tensing with excitement. "We'll steal the hollow and bring him back here, restart Mr. Bentham's machine, open a door to the White's Fortress, and get our friends back."
"Simple," Sharon said, and he let out a barking laugh. "Except for that last part."
"And the first," I said. Emma stepped close to me. "Sorry, love. I volunteered your services without asking. Think you can handle that hollow?" I wasn't sure. True, I'd been able to make it perform a few spectacular moves in Fever Ditch, but bringing it to heel like a puppy and leading it all the way back to Bentham's house was asking a great deal of my rudimentary hollow-taming skills. My confidence, too, was at an all-time low after my last disastrous encounter, but everything hinged on me being able to do it. "Of course I can handle it," I took too long to say. "When can we go?" Bentham clapped his hands.
"That's the spirit!"
Emma's gaze lingered on my face. She could tell I was faking.
"You can leave as soon as you're ready," Bentham said. "Sharon will be your guide." "We shouldn't wait," Sharon said. "Once the locals have had their fun with that hollow, I'll reckon they'll kill it."
Emma picked at the front of her poofy dress. "In that case, I think we should change."
"Naturally," said Bentham,
and he sent Nim to find us clothes more befitting our errand. He returned a minute later with thick-soled boots and modern work pants and jackets, black, waterproof, and with a bit of stretch to them. We retreated to separate rooms to change, and then met in a hallway, just Emma and me dressed in our adventure clothes. Rough and shapeless, they made Emma look slightly mannish, though not in a bad way, but she didn't grumble. She just tied back her hair, snapped her head to attention, and saluted me.
"Sergeant Bloom reporting for duty."
"Purtiest soldier I ever did see,"
I said, drawling out a terrible John Wayne impression. There was a direct correlation between how nervous I was and how many dumb jokes I made. And right now, I was practically quaking, my stomach a leaky faucet dripping acid all over my insides. "You really think we can do this?" I said.
"I do," she said.
"You never doubt, ever?" Emma shook her head.
"Doubt is the pinprick in a life raft."
She stepped close, and we hugged. I could feel her trembling ever so slightly. She wasn't bulletproof. I knew then that my shaky faith in myself was starting to dig a hole in hers, and Emma's confidence was what held everything together. It was the life raft. I'd come to regard her faith in me as somewhat reckless.
She seemed to think that I should be able to snap my fingers and make Hologast dance at will, that I was allowing some inner weakness to block my ability. Part of me resented that, and part of me wondered if maybe she was right. The only way to find out for sure was to approach the next hollow with an unshakable belief that I could master it.
"I wish I could see myself the way you do,"
I whispered. She hugged me harder, and I resolved to try. Sharon and Bentham came into the hall.
"Ready?"
Sharon asked. We let go of each other.
"Ready,"
I said. Bentham shook my hand, then Emma's.
"I'm so happy you're here," he said. "It's proof, I think, that the stars are beginning to align for us."
"I hope you're right," Emma said. We were about to go when a question came to me that I'd been meaning to ask the whole time, and it occurred to me that, in a worst-case scenario, this could be my last chance to ask it.
"Mr. Bentham," I said, "we never did talk about my grandfather. How did you know him? Why were you looking for him?"
Bentham's eyebrows shot up, and then he smiled quickly, as if to cover his moment of surprise.
"I missed him, that's all," he said. "We were old friends, and I hoped I might see him again one day."
I knew that wasn't the whole truth, and I could see in Emma's narrowed eyes that she knew it too. But there was no time to dig any further. Right now, the future was of much greater concern than the past. Bentham raised his hand goodbye.
"Be careful out there," he said. "I'll be here, preparing my Panlupticon for its triumphant return to service."
And then he hobbled back into his library, and we could hear him shouting at his bear,
"P.T., up! We have work to do!"
Sharon led us down a long hall, his wooden staff swinging and his massive bare feet slapping the stone floor. When we came to the door that led outside, he stopped, bent down to match our height, and laid out his ground rules.
"It's dangerous where we're going. There are very few unowned peculiar children left in Devil's Acre, so people will notice you. Don't speak unless spoken to. Don't look anyone in the eye. Follow me at a slight distance, but never lose sight of me. We'll pretend you're my slaves."
"What?" said Emma. "We will not."
"It's the safest thing," said Sharon.
"It's demeaning."
"Yes, but it will raise the fewest questions."
"How do we do it?" I said.
"Just do whatever I say, immediately and without question, and keep a slightly glazed expression."
"Yes, master," I said robotically. "Not like that," Emma said. "He means like the kids in that awful place on Loose Lane." I let my face slacken and said in a flat voice, "Hello. We're all very happy here." Emma shuddered and turned away.
"Very good," said Sharon, and then he looked at Emma. "Now you try."
"If we must do this," she said, "I'll pretend to be mute." That was good enough for Sharon. He opened the door and swept us out into the dying day. Chapter 5. The air outside was a toxic-looking yellowish soup, such that I couldn't tell the position of the sun in the sky except to say it must have been getting toward evening, the light slowly leaking away. We walked a few paces behind Sharon, struggling to keep up whenever he saw someone he knew on the street, and sped up to avoid conversation. People seemed to know him. He had a reputation,
and I think he was concerned that we might do something to ruin it. We made our way down oddly cheerful, oozing street